You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Believe it or not, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson yet again, and today is Wednesday, June 9th, 2021. Our life, our struggle gets more and more difficult, but because of my supporters and listeners, whether it be in writing, whether it be in this broadcast, whether it be on Thursdays, all the things I do outside of Albion, there's the endless speeches and everything I'm doing. My supporters have made it possible for me to function independently here, which is a miracle, which very few people thought was possible. When I got this started in, I believe, 2009, this broadcast here with the Voice of Reason. If you were to ask me what happened to Voice of Reason, I have no answer for you. I simply don't know. It simply hasn't been functional in a very long time, which is a shame. So, as always, I thank my my supporters. I thank them for not just financially, but morally and diplomatically and every other way you could you can think of. And it means a lot to me. I spent a lot of time on this show attacking the various color revolutions. Of course, I developed a theory many, many years ago. We talked about Tiananmen Square not too long ago as one of the first. And this was really, the Cold War was just, you know, coming to an end. The Soviet Union had not imploded quite yet. But clearly there was an attack on, and you know, of course, you know, the Chinese, you know my position on that. The Chinese are you know, anything but communists in the Leninist or Maoist sense of the term. They're a national socialist state and function very much like one. And they're treated accordingly. All of a sudden, it's now fashionable to hate them. Whenever the regime, you know, is supporting something, as it did for Marxism for so long, then suddenly turns on it. Something has happened. The ideology of whatever the country is or the group is has changed. Suddenly it's become fashionable to hate communists, whether it be in Russia or China. And now, of course, they're sanitizing. They do it in North Korea, too, trying to make North Korea a right-wing state rather than a leftist one. Well, the differences would be extreme. People aren't educated enough in political philosophy to understand the differences. But there's been many of these on every continent, and they all have a very similar trajectory. However, they have a few things in common. One, of course, is that, and the main one that I'm talking about here, is that it requires your typical educated reader in the West to be totally ignorant about the country that it's subject to, that they're targeting. That's the issue. And so many of these color revolutions have been in countries that are extremely significant and strategic, but are completely off the radar screen, even a very well-educated Westerners and Americans. Now, I've said for many years, and I'll continue to say it, that the average educated American, every belief of his is incorrect. He lives in a fantasy world. But as times continue to change, even that's now starting to change. They're quiet about it. They're scared. They don't want to be, you know, I use a symbol of not being invited to the cocktail party as a symbol for losing respectability. But as small businesses are destroyed, as Great Reset takes over from the New World Order, etc., even the regime's biggest supporters, conservative or otherwise, are starting to turn on it. The worst thing that could happen to a regime is when the people who normally would be its backbone, its winners, its high IQ, high motivation, successful people, suddenly turn on it. Then it has no one to rely on. At least no one decent. Then it's going to start relying on force and manipulation. And that's happening slowly but surely. And as this is going on, this is a brand new variable in American politics that no one is really, they're not systematizing it. They're talking about it, but not as part of a broader theory on what's happening. Action is predicated on theory. If you're going to act to change something, you have to have something you want to change it into. And you have to know this in detail if you're going to suffer for it. You guys know for 20 years, I have been a defender of Lukashenko in Belarus. You may have noticed, I spoke about this on, not last Thursday, the Thursday before, that for a while he was front page news concerning the FR-4978 airliner from the Irish carrier Ryanair flying from Athens to Lithuania, Greece to Lithuania, which was, according to the regime, hijacked on the 23rd of May. Last I checked, the EU is now banning Belarusian airliners from using any European airport. And, you know, for so many years, I referred, even when John McCain was around, the Bush administration, Obama administration, that so many actions of the regime, whether it be the U.S. or the EU, amounts to a declaration of war on Russia. The regime doesn't fully understand the Belarusian-Russian distinction, so it really is one and the same. And they see, whether it be Ukraine or Belarus, as possible weak links in the Slavic world. Belarus has been a giant failure for the regime because of the nature of the Belarusian economy. Now, I've dealt with this for so long. I was most certainly the first one to even talk about Lukashenko in a positive way. Remember, when I first started dealing with Putin and then later, or Lukashenko even before Putin, I should say, these guys were still condemned by the right, all elements of the right, as communists. And Lukashenko even uses the Red Star and has the KGB, and they didn't understand it. They don't really know what a communist is. Obviously, if you have private enterprise and a free press and a functional church, you can't be you're not a Leninist. You're not a communist in any normal sense of the term. I was the first to say, both China, Russia, of course, and most certainly Belarus, as excellent examples of national socialism or social nationalism. Social nationalism is what I used to describe Lukashenko, the Occidental Observer, many years ago, in a very well-received article published there. His economic success, President Lukashenko, has been nothing short of miraculous. And he did it by throwing the IMF out of the country and attaching his economy to not only Russia, Armenia, Iran, and China. These massive growing markets, this huge first world, highly prosperous civilization, almost. The axis of resistance, as we call it now. Lukashenko also refused all COVID lockdown restrictions. In fact, when this was first declared over a year ago, he had a Victory Day parade organized precisely to piss these people off. And of course, he has a very low infection rate. I think something like 3,000 may have died allegedly of that illness, or that's what they claim. The population is 10 million, with about, 3.5 million outside of the country. A lot of the time, color revolutions are aimed at countries precisely because they're successful. And that's a standing assault on liberalism the official ideology of both the New World Order and Great Reset. One follows the other. That is a violent, extremely violent totalitarian ideology, except in their case, it relies mostly on private sector power, financing the public sector, to the point where those two sectors aren't really separate, but they maintain the image that they're separate. And that goes back, as I've said many times, to Renaissance Florence, where the Medici family controlled every penny that came in and out of there, but used a set of politicians and the old constitutional state to hide behind. And of course, that's Machiavelli comes out of all of this. And this whole mentality that's radically changed from medieval to modern thinking. The color revolution is an attempt of a dying Western world. Liberal capitalism, so-called liberal democracy, that can't pay its bills, that has chaos in its streets, a dying, alienated, shrinking population, invaded by migrants that don't produce much, increasingly drowning in crime, with nothing to offer at any level, except maybe porn and sports, running out of money, attempting to subvert much healthier, much more successful societies. And as the West continues its decline, these attempts are going to get more and more violent. They're going to be more of a lashing out rather than any kind of a strongly planned set of events. And that's the fear. When you wound and corner an animal, that's when you're in the most danger. And that's where the regime is right now. They are anything but invincible. They can't be defeated, however, without foreign assistance. North Vietnam wasn't able to win without the assistance of both China and the Soviet Union. Anyway, the element of the color revolution in Lukashenko we're talking about today is the Ryanair diversion on the 23rd of May. Now, I've talked about in the Navalny case and the situation in Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, there's so many, they're all the same. It's this same the same cycle of these nobody, unpopular opposition leaders who exist only from Western money, who have a small base of support given unearned power because of events like this. So anyway, Ryanair was a plane going from Athens to Vilnius, forced to make an emergency landing in Minsk due to what was said at the time was a bomb threat. On board was a liberal blogger of no significance named Roman Protasevich. The West immediately stated that the bomb, of course, which did not exist, was a massive conspiracy theory. The conspiracy theories are okay if their enemies do them, whereby the president of Belarus wanted so badly to arrest this threat to him, Protasevich, that he invented this whole scam of having a bomb on a plane that doesn't exist, so he had an excuse to force it to land and then have him arrested. Of course, thereby making him an international celebrity. Lukashenko, because of his social nationalist ideology and a very, very orthodox man, is maybe one of the regime's most hated figures. He's just more obscure than the rest, so he doesn't get a lot of attention. The media's narrative in all of these cases is very suspicious because it's already played out. It's just the same script, just the names and countries have been changed. The narrative is stated in its full form maybe 10 minutes after the event, like they received the script, because they did. I wrote the very first article criticizing the 9/11 story solely on the grounds that when the second plane hit within 15 minutes, they already claimed that they knew it was Osama bin Laden, who we all know was very, very sick at the time with no money. We've talked about that before. He eventually died a few months later in Pakistan of kidney failure, which has plagued him for years at that point. No other theory was ever promoted. Nothing else ever came up. No other possible scenario was ever mentioned. And yet, within 15 minutes, if I remember it very well, I was in D.C. at the time, they had him pegged with no evidence, and the narrative was unchanged from that moment on. No one but me asked how could they possibly know that it was him, especially since he condemned it. He condemned the entire operation, one of the few leaders like that who did, and had no money and no authority at the time. It's a incredibly complicated operation. But that's what they stuck with. It's the same thing here. Not only do they have this, narrative immediately planned out, and there was absolutely no deviation from it in any mainstream news source. But the EU imposed new sanctions against Belarus almost immediately because of this. Very short time later, the 27 leaders in the EU, without any evidence or any investigation, attacked Belarus for allegedly forcing this flight, FR-4978, to land in Minsk, then called for the immediate release of Protasevich, who up until this point they probably knew nothing about, and his suspiciously new girlfriend, Sofia Sapiega, who, if you look into her background, was his liaison to George Soros. They're not together. They've only known each other for a few months. Now, he was arrested and said in public that he was being treated properly. Now, there's no reason for anything else to be the case, since all eyes were on the Belarusian government at the time. Everyone there knows that the West is looking for every possible reason to condemn him, so he's going to be treated with kid gloves, to say the least. Immediately, of course, the Western media invented stories of his being tortured in prison with no evidence and no witnesses. Now, he confessed to inciting mass riots, except that he said that many times before. He said it on the air before. So, he said, and this is a quote directly from him after he was arrested. He said, "I can declare that I have no problems with my health, neither my heart or any other organs. Police officers are treating me absolutely correctly and according to the law. I'm currently continuing to cooperate with the investigation, and I'm giving a confession to the organization of mass arrests in the city of Minsk." Now, that's a very rapid translation. What he meant is mass riots in the city of Minsk. But that's nothing new, because he has said that before. He's been proud of that fact. Again, immediately, governments in the EU and all of its press claimed immediately the confession was coerced without evidence or witnesses, despite the fact that he said that many times in the past. As always, these agencies never approach the government. They never approach anyone involved in the incident. They never go to the Ministry of Justice or Transportation Ministry or the Belarusian Embassy or anyone else and get their opinion. They took official statements from the EU, from NGOs, corporations, and assumed it was true without investigation or witnesses of any kind. Now, for every color revolution, this is what happens. There's no distinctions here. And the way that these things are written, you're talking about people who are writing on this story. These are not professional journalists who deal with foreign affairs. They have no particular specialty in the area. They're simply given a script and they go along with it. And since this happened, now in late May, there hasn't been a single deviance from this in any official press organ. Now, sanctions against Belarus are very heavy, but there's no good reasons for this, of course. It doesn't mean a whole lot to Belarus, since their trade with the West really is German, and Germany doesn't listen to any, they won't follow any sanctions whatsoever. But this invented story gave the West an excuse to intensify its war against Belarus. But even the aviation lobby in Europe, IATA, condemned the notion of banning Belarusian flights. What does that have to do with what happened, especially since they don't know what happened? Even more severe actions are being contemplated by the regime against both Belarus and now Russia's involved. Russia had nothing to do with this. We'll see here in a minute that Belarus had nothing to do with this. The entire narrative was in place from the beginning, and the press read it by rote. They read it out by rote. The regime claims that the diversion of this plane, and this is a direct quote, an unprecedented and unacceptable incident. It comes from EU made that, and I saw that in Al Jazeera and a few other places. But most of you remember that this has happened many times before. The Western regime has forced planes down to arrest people many times. In 2010, a plane from France to Mexico, this is mentioned in RT, was forced to land by the U.S. to arrest someone. In 2012, Turkey forced a passenger jet from Moscow to land in Ankara on a tip, allegedly, that there was military equipment on board that was not legal Russian military equipment was on board. And they were ordered by NATO to stop it and inspect it. There's two particularly blatant examples of this. The 2013 one I kind of forgot about. The president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, who was at an energy summit in Moscow, or in Russia, had his presidential plane forced to land. Most of the EU had refused it access to its airports, could not be able to go and didn't have enough fuel to go anywhere else. It was forced to land in Austria. And the whole thing was based on a false tip that Edward Snowden was on board, which is almost identical to this Belarusian case. The U.S. even annulled Snowden's passport. Now, Evo Morales has been anti-New World Order from the beginning, and he said he may even grant Snowden's political asylum. Of course, police in Vienna didn't find him, and once the whole thing was a bust, France and Spain eventually apologized for their part in this disaster. And yet, I don't recall any international outrage over this. The worst that I do remember this, was in 2016. Ukraine, which is a colony of the U.S. and the EU, threatened to shoot down an airliner from Belarus unless it landed and turned over an Armenian Matrosian, Armen Matrosian, who was an anti-Maidan, anti-globalization journalist. There was no crime even alleged at the time. Fighter jets were dispatched, but believe it or not, Ukraine could actually muster two fighter jets to force this plane to land and disgorged the reporter who was on board, who was very critical, among other things, of the Ukraine's colonial relationship to the U.S. Because there was no charges, he was quickly released. And nothing came of it. It was really just a method of showing that we can do whatever we want. Still, though, the Belarusian case, the European Council condemned the diversion of the plane by Belarus as an unprecedented and unacceptable incident. But to claim that it's never happened before assumes, as they always do, that too few are going to remember anything else to be able to say. Only RT asks any pertinent questions, or even bothered to wonder who Protasevich is, or what the evidence against him was, or what the heck he did. Now, the term for a colonial regime writer is an independent journalist. Independent journalist means that he's under the control of Western corporations in some fashion or another. Certainly, Protasevich is not a journalist or a writer of any note. He's a media-invented personality. There never are these things. He's considered a minor liberal writer, supported entirely by foreign money, with a non-Belarusian subscriber base, and he's based outside of the country, either in Poland or Lithuania. So RT wrote on the 25th of May, they said, it's no great secret that the U.S. has been investing in regime change in Belarus and was possibly involved in an assassination attempt. Protasevich edits the Belomova Telegram channel and previously had overseen the Polish base Nexta, which has helped to organize protests in Belarus. And he also worked for the U.S. state-run Euroradio and RFERL, which used to be a CIA front and then was taken over by Soros and a banking cartel. Now, the fact that he's written for state-controlled media, this controlled by the West, tells a lot of the story. The rest of these are organizations funded by foreigners. Now, I've been analyzing this phenomenon for 20 years, and there is the very fact that Western forces have fully admitted doing this, that they finance the opposition. The opposition wouldn't exist otherwise. They've admitted this over and over again. Journalists in the West refuse to acknowledge it or care about it. The assumption is that the average educated reader will have too little knowledge on the subject to contradict the story, which is the foundation of Johnson's Law. The way that color revolutions are reported in the West, it assumes Johnson's Law is true. But even those who may have some background knowledge in these areas, their sources of information usually are simply Western mainstream, and they're fed the same kind of nonsense that everyone else is. Many of them simply don't know where else to go for information. Now, there's another element here that made me laugh. What happens often in these cases, if you remember the make-believe killing of Osama bin Laden, which was a ridiculous story, it never happened. They were talking about the books that he had in his office. And of course, they listed all the right-wing leaders that they hate in America. I mentioned David Duke, I don't know who else, you know, William Pierce, whatever, I forget the name, but it was someone like that. All the publications they hate, they all had those in his office. They do this all the time. They try to piggyback their favorite issues onto these things. In this case, it was Hamas. The claim at the time was that the Belarusian government was accusing Hamas of calling in a threat to the Ministry of Transportation. Now, people who know realize that both Russia and Belarus have supported the Palestinian cause and have financially, in every other way, aided both Hamas and Hezbollah. So the only reason that this fake thing could have ever been even mentioned, it came from Western sources, or it came from the so-called opposition in Belarus themselves, to create dissension among two allies. Hamas and Belarus has always had very good, very close relations. Now here's what this statement allegedly said from Hamas. Now listen to this here. I mean, you don't have to be a PhD in this field to understand how ridiculous this sounds. We, Hamas soldiers, demand that Israel cease fire in the Gaza Strip. We demand that the European Union renounce its support for Israel in this war. It's known that the participants in the Delphi Economic Forum are returning home on flight 4978. A bomb has been planted on this plane. If you do not fulfill our demands, the bomb will explode on May 23rd over Vilnius. Vilnius in Lithuania. And this, you know, went through several editors and actually is taken seriously by people. This is not only a forgery, but it's a ridiculous one. Hamas is a very astute political organization that's done very well electorally in the occupied territory. They struggle every day to build their reputation as legitimate, both a guerrilla force, a military force, and a political force. To issue a threat like this would, first of all, have no relation to the war on Gaza at all, would destroy their reputation, and would only inflame European opinion against them, which is something at the time, of course, Israel desperately needs. The level of error in actually believing this stupid statement that they allegedly sent, the level of ignorance you would have to display to believe this to be legitimate, just shows you exactly what we're up against here. As if threatening a plane with allies on it over Belarus, Vilnius, whatever it is, actually occurred over a nuclear plant in Belarus where it first was announced to them. They know that no threat or a set of threats is ever going to eliminate EU support for Israel. For 60 years, rebel groups of all types have tried to stop Europeans from subsidizing Israel. And that hasn't worked. But Hamas allegedly thinks that a threat of a bomb on a plane from an allied country would help. Why target the economic forum? There's so many other, even more elite forums to attack. Why only the plane going over Belarus? Why not do this over more militantly pro-Zionist countries like Germany or the UK? Why there? Then, of course, the spokesman from Hamas, Barhum, Farzi Barhum, said, "We don't resort to these methods. This could be the doing of some suspicious parties that aim to demonize Hamas and foil the state of world sympathy with our Palestinian people and their legitimate resistance." Well, no kidding. He knows this is exactly correct. Hamas is not a terrorist group. It is a popular guerrilla army with substantial local support and a proven track record of victories and impressive social service. Any act like this, or a threat like this, would immediately destroy the reputation among its own supporters worldwide, and then only confirm Western prejudices against them. I talked about in the Iranian nuclear case. Killing innocent people on purpose is condemned by Hamas and many groups like this. Several fatwa have been issued against such methods. The Iranian fatwa against stockpiling nuclear or chemical weapons comes to mind, which people don't even know exist. Islamic countries may not have nuclear weapons. Nuclear power is okay, but that's very different from nuclear weapons. Two very different scientific processes. The claim is that Belarus somehow invented this Hamas threat to justify hijacking of the plane. That makes even less sense than Hamas sending it. Why invent a threat from an ally? Why just being destroyed over Belarus or Vilnius? Why give aid and comfort to the Israeli and hence the American cause? No one in Belarus could ever believe this to be real. I mean, if they were going to invent a threat, it would be from an enemy group supported by the West, not a fellow member of the Axis of Resistance. It seems like this ridiculous statement is like written by a low-level intelligence trainee or intern at Amnesty International. You know, it's like to the same group of people who posted the ridiculously photoshopped ISIS execution videos. So every single aspect of this story is not just absurd, but impossible. Now, despite initially reporting that Belarus claimed Hamas planted the bomb, the Belarusian government merely acknowledged that the threat itself was written in their name. At most, it was initially reported by the Ministry of Transportation, was certainly never stated by the government as such, which is an impossibility. There was never any belief that this was true. They said that's what this threat was signed, which came over email, of all things, from an IP address, apparently, in Switzerland. Not a shred of this, it can't be true, and none of it makes any sense. So, but this is how these color revolution things go. It assumes public ignorance, which, of course, it's correct to do so. It deals with piggybacking issues. You know, attaching the Hamas thing with Israel to a hijacking, allegedly, of a plane, which, according to them, never happened before, to arrest a minor idiot blogger kid, but turning him into an international superstar overnight, who before was a minimal figure. Well, the plane was diverted just before leaving Belarusian airspace. Now, claiming that the purpose was to arrest Protasevich, it itself doesn't make a whole lot of sense because his arrest wouldn't affect his page anyway, since it's based outside of the country. See, as the Navalny case and so many of these other things I've talked about, others have talked about, any arrest like this would immediately give legitimacy to these minor groups. They're always small and relatively unpopular. Let's mention the fact that the Belarusian KGB could have arrested him anywhere. To use this massive, giant, complicated ruse that doesn't even make sense to arrest a nobody in order to make him an international celebrity, that goes even beyond journalistic standards of credulity. Now, RT initially, you know, asked some good questions. It was South Front, certainly one of my favorite news sources. Just began asking even more basic questions about this. All I have to do is ask basic questions. This isn't you don't have to really be super knowledgeable about it. Now, what they discovered is that it seems that the liberal opposition in Belarus created, or deliberately created, the situation and knew what was going to happen in advance. His Telegram channel had a message from Protasevich from the air just before this happened, communicated from the plane to someone on the ground, or maybe he did it directly. I don't know if the technologies, how high they were, whatever it was. I don't understand that part of it, but they were able to communicate even beforehand that he claimed that GRU officers, for certain, he said, were following him. He gave no grounds for this claim, and he had no way of knowing this. Now, assuming he had no knowledge of it from the start, he was starting a narrative just in case the worst happened, because knowing that there's an arrest warrant in Belarus for him, diverting the plane to Belarus must have sent him into a panic state. He claims that one of these men tried to take a photo of his documents as the plane began its descent. Well, if he was going to be arrested anyway, why take pictures of his documents now? And why would he have sensitive documents in plain sight? Again, simple questions, the whole thing falls apart. This is Protasevich here saying this. Speaking of these agents, he said, I was silent, and he turned to me in Russian with some stupid question. Such a middle-aged, fit with bald head, wanted a t-shirt, light-colored pants, and a leather case. That was his evidence that these were military intelligence operatives on the plane, serving as participants in this almost comically complicated conspiracy. What we have to know is that the Belarusian government didn't give any order for the plane to land. That decision was made both by the control tower and the pilots, not to mention the airline. The chat log is has been published. The Belarusian government has pushed it, as has the airline. And the Belarusian government made these public. Hardly a rational move if this was a giant conspiracy. So South Front wrote this, and this is under, I don't remember if this was in Russian or not. I think it was. I think this was initially in Russian. Here's how they describe it. The crew commander of the aircraft, of the Ryanair aircraft, informed Minsk about the bomb on May 23rd. At that time, the plane was already near the Lithuanian border, but pilots decided to act in accordance with international security instructions and request a landing in Minsk. A recording of the pilot's call with the dispatcher had been already published online. It confirmed the pilots made the decision to land in Minsk. At that moment, the Minsk airport received an email about a bomb on board. The crew's decision to land in Minsk was also confirmed by reports from the communications department of the Lithuanian International Airport. After the call, the information was reported to President Lukashenko, who gave the command to take measures and secure the landing. The Belarusian Air Force dealt with this emergency according to international standards, the MiG-29 following the aircraft to provide assistance, to make sure it landed. At that moment, a photo of Protasevich appeared online with reports about his arrest. It was published by one of the assistants of Svetlana Tikhanovskaya on a Twitter account, and the photo was allegedly sent by the opposition team by Protasevich's so-called girlfriend, who was flying with him for internal use. But they rushed to post it on the internet even before official reports of his arrest were filed. That's my apparently very rapid translation from the Russian. The Russian original. This may have been published in English since then, I don't know. Just by itself, the very fact that they published the chat logs proves this whole thing is a media invention from the start. The government had nothing to do with the order to land and heard about it only after the decision was made. So it was at the private level, the airline, Lithuanian airport, pilots, if this is a real threat, you land a plane in Minsk. This is the protocol. Reports on his arrest already appeared on Telegram in real time somehow. They had the narrative ready as soon as he saw someone who might look like a GRU agent, knowing full well what the Western media's reaction would be. And it was only South Front that noticed that this event occurred just before the first European summit was about to begin, where the regime would be discussing Russian affairs, among other things. So, of course, the point was to prejudice the summit leaders and move Europe closer to war. That was the point. The South Front authors also said that European countries were going to discuss new restrictions against Minsk before the incident, but after the international scandal, the topic became the main one of the forum's agenda. In other words, restrictions on Belarusian air travel were already on the agenda before this occurred. Protasevich was no threat to anyone. I talked about this with Navalny and so many others. I mean, I could go through the list. They're not either popular or even well-known figures. Like most of the opposition leaders financed by the West, he doesn't have many followers, given massive PR assistance and a laughably sympathetic media. I mean, there are classical tuba players on YouTube with more subscribers than this guy. Now, as it stands, this was as of a couple of days ago, despite a week of saturation media coverage and huge State Department EU PR campaign, his Next to channel has 586,000 subscribers. This is after the international saturation media coverage. He has that many. Of course, prior to these events, it was much, much less than that. The story never seems to change. Now, this also happened, and this I did forget about. Volvan and Lexus, these are two Russian, I don't know what to call them, parrots, maybe? They called the leadership, they called the National Endowment for Democracy. And they pretended to be part of the team of, you know, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the so-called opposition leader against Lukashenko in Belarus. Probably has the same level of popularity as, you know, as this guy does. And they actually got to talk to the president, Carl Gershman. And they were convincing, and he believed that it was actually them, and he said that the NED has always financed and directed the opposition in both Russia and Belarus, and even implicated that Leonid Volkov, one of the leaders of the Anti-Corruption Foundation, of course, is simply their agent. Then Gershman says the Biden administration, I'll put that in quotes, of course, will continue to support the opposition and continue to support their legitimate demand, all the rhetoric. So you can't really call them an opposition if they're directed and financed by enemy states. They're agents. They're not an opposition. Opposition to Lukashenko is very small, given that there's no way any other leader could possibly run the country better under the circumstances. His record is extraordinary. Now, I didn't need these guys, and it's funny, of course, but I didn't need them to do that to know that this is how it's been for two decades. But it's funny, the clueless bureaucrat, having no idea what he's doing, getting a phone call from this so-called opposition leader, and then, you know, spilling his guts to her. I'm not sure. I think it was her assistant. Yeah, they had the accent. They made it sound right. You know, it came out. How were they contacted him? It came up, you know, a foreign account, whatever. And it shows you how clueless this man is. Thinks that he's so important, she's going to call me directly, whatever it is. And the incident that we're talking about here occurred just a short time after this prank, whatever you want to call it, and embarrassed these groups. So after that, and just before the European summit. Clearly, of course, nothing's ever a coincidence in these things. I think some of you realize just how close to war that Europe is building based on this ridiculous story against one of the most popular politicians in the world right now. So the incident was invented. It was created by the so-called liberal opposition based abroad, and to some extent their sponsors in intelligence elsewhere. But whether it be the chronology of events, the photographs released even before boarding the plane, the pilot's reports, the decision of the crew to turn around, and even basic logical analysis proves that there's no question about this. It was the so-called liberal opposition that created this whole story. Now, I'm not sure even if Protasevich was personally involved, but I'm sure he has enemies. I mentioned in the Navalny story that Yabloko, the liberal group, had turned him in, accusing him of fraud, taking money from them and not delivering on advertising, whatever stupid story it was, And they got angry and they actually turned him into the authority. So they turn on each other all the time. They don't have principles. This is a narcissistic group of people. They're interested in power. The minute they take power, they're going to shut down all actual media, just like they did in Ukraine and everywhere else. The minute they take over, it'll be a massive clampdown, which is what it always has. Liberalism is a violent totalitarian ideology. And of course, the first thing that'll happen is Western corporations will come in and buy up state assets and everything else, especially in the energy sector. And the truth is, and we keep forgetting about this, is that liberal groups in Poland and Lithuania aimed at Belarus are always competing with each other for Western money and support. And they don't have a lot of internal support. Their internal sources of financing are minimal. Oligarchs, you know, it really is all they had. But even there, in Belarus, there's only so much money they're going to give that they haven't been successful. But because they're always competing, you know, sacrificing this guy may have actually been settling a lot of scores. So, given everything we know now, the Belarusian authorities were tipped off by members of this or their liberal rivals in the opposition, which means that the government's reaction would force the hand of their sponsors for more cash and diplomatic support. You know, how does it work in Ukraine, where you don't really have a functional economy? They're completely dependent on handouts from banks and corporations and the Western world. The only thing they actually have to offer the West, other than sex slaves, is the promise to militarily act against Russia, or military any other way. That means they always have to be inventing reasons to keep the West financing them. So they'll invent Russian invasions and Russian media, Russian bots. Because if the U.S. finally, or the EU finally gets sick of them, saying we're not going to throw money at a dying economy that is so corrupt that there's no point in doing business there. I mean, they've given the same thing for Albania. They've sunk billions of dollars in loans they know they're never going to see again. I mean, they're willing to go bankrupt over this, but only to a point. They're not going to keep giving loans they know they're never going to see again. And these liberal, tiny liberal groups are aware of this. In Belarus especially, they've been so marginal. And Lukashenko remains very popular. And so they're competing for money and support. Is one of the reasons I think this happened. And I think this is really was South Front's argument as well. I spoke last week about Assad's re-election, where he received, on May 26th, he won with a 95% majority in the elections in Syria, at least in the sections of the country that the government controls, which is most of it. His opponents, which were given fair free time on Sana, which is a state media organization, which is very fair to them. I've actually read the articles. Mahmoud Meri and Abdallah Salim Abdallah. They couldn't, you know, they polled maybe 5% total, which is about right. There is no unified opposition there. This is Western finance mercenaries. You can't run for president if you're violently attacking the government or if you have a long criminal record. So this is the best they can do, these two unknowns. And many of them campaigned on doing the same thing that Assad does, it's just better. You can't campaign on a pro-US, pro-Israel platform there. And it makes sense that a man who was victorious over the entire world, coming down in his little country, is going to be very, very popular. A man who didn't even want power. He was a successful doctor in Britain. His brother Basil was supposed to take over and was killed in the car accident, legitimate or not. He took power because he had no other choice. He didn't want it. He took power out of necessity and out of duty. Of course, as I've said many times, in the Belarusian case and all these cases, Western governments, especially the U.S., imagine the Biden administration condemning vote fraud. But they, I have the proof here, they wrote in April their press release that the Syrian elections are fraudulent and no international monitors were there to inspect the elections. That was written in April. But the election wasn't until around this very same time. It was May 26th. But you had monitoring delegations. You had them from Russia, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Bolivia, Ecuador, Armenia, and a few others. I think Azerbaijan. I can't remember. But the Western world refused to send anybody. Because if they sent people, they either have to lie and make up stories that it's not free or fair, or have to say it's okay. It was high turnout, of course. In rebel or Western-held areas, of course, no one was allowed to vote. And one of the most interesting things about Assad's victory was Syrians who could vote outside of Syria, in the U.S. and the U.K. and elsewhere, were not allowed to. Now, Syrians in Lebanon voted overwhelmingly for Assad, which is not surprising. And Western terror groups were actually really trying, doing everything they could to destroy the election. Neither free nor fair. They said this in April, maybe before then. I mean, this is very typical. Now you had UAE, Oman, Iran, Jordan, Bahrain, Jordan, Lebanon, Kuwait. They allowed Syrians to vote. And you're seeing, because Assad clearly won in rebuilding the economy with Chinese and Russian assistance, they're now approaching him again as a normal ruler. 70% of the country is just under Assad's control. Of course, he's an extremely popular man. I was the one who reported that before the shooting war began there, the pro-Assad rallies were massive. They were 10 times the size of his opposition. Pro-Hezbollah, I mean, I talked about this in the Lebanese case, in Lebanon, you had a Beirut demonstration of over 1 million people with Assad's picture a few years ago. And the West claimed that you can't have an election during the time of massive war, even though there was an American presidential election during the Civil War. So they simply invent things. They're not putting any effort really into it. And they assume again that people are too stupid and simply too ignorant, they're too busy to even worry about it. And if it comes up, they'll repeat the same nonsense that they hear. It doesn't take a whole lot to tear apart these ridiculous narratives. I talk about the Assad case because it goes to prove that, you know, Assad was always very popular. The economy was doing very well. The Civil War is not something that they blame him for. How could they? Every Syrian is well aware of this. The opposition candidates opposing Assad still had to admit what the West was doing. You couldn't get two votes unless you said things like that, not in today's Syria. These opposition groups were financed by the West, were violent or otherwise. And God help these people if they ever took over. It proves the strength of people like Assad. It proves how popular they are and how literally and metaphorically bankrupt the West is. Syria's economy is actually growing with, again, foreign investment. But these people like Protasevich and Navalny go from pretty much zeros to men of international standing only because they've been arrested and they get into trouble and the media spout their with no knowledge, no witness, no understanding. I mean, the best case scenario for some of these people that the West would eventually install them as titular rulers, similar to what happened in Kiev or even Georgia years ago. That's their only motive. But the Belarusian government's motive, they were arresting a criminal. What the man did, what he advocated, would be cause for arrest in every country on the globe. That's not an issue. He not only did he advocate killing of Belarusian cops, but he was involved in a doxing scheme to release Belarusian police officers' identities and addresses. This guy is in serious trouble. By forcing the plane to land, of course, they did what the West has done many times. I gave the list of examples. The Ukrainian one, a few years ago, is one of the most outrageous. And the ridiculous thing, the piggybacking like the Hamas angle, we know how certain our conclusion is here. The Belarusian motivation is to arrest a criminal. But they could have arrested him anywhere. It's ridiculous that this guy, you know, and even if they did arrest him and throw him in jail, his channel is still going to function. It's not in Belarus. What would that have to do with anything? Having 500,000 subscribers after a week of saturation coverage shows you this man is a nobody. But it's nothing surprising. Again, the Loboka party case in the mind of Navalny stuff. Liberal leaders in Eastern Europe will use the authorities to get rid of rivals. And they think they're going to force a more equitable distribution of foreign tax dollars, corporation money to them. But Lukashenko, like Assad, they go from success to success. So the sources of money for those supporting their failed opposition, they're going to dry up. Just like in Syria, these opposition figures in Russia and Belarus, maybe 5% they can get. I mean, 10% with a massive push, events like this. I mean, they need these front page events. You would have to invent them totally. The money's going to quickly dry up. And that was confirmed with the Gershman prank conversation. I mean, the money, the oligarchy does throw money at lost causes. The IMF has been underwriting loans for Ukraine and Albania, knowing full well that they will never see that money again. But they also know that this is what's going to keep these liberal governments in power. So Belarus, as it stands, and has been, simply too prosperous and successful to create anything but a small, purely urban opposition movement of elite kids. So some of these guys are going to move their dollars elsewhere. So stunts like this become a necessity. They need to create these kind of incidents because this is the only way they're going to keep the money flowing. It's not, you know, it's far even worse than that in the sense that the oligarchs' press in the West defended the other actions of forcing planes to land. There was no international outcry about this. And again, this interesting, if you're a reporter, unless you're a hardened sociopath, defending one and not the other is going to introduce a massive level of cognitive dissonance. It's going to be very hard to bear. I think one of the reasons that sociopaths do so well is that they have no concept of cognitive dissonance. Now, the general public doesn't care. Of course, they don't even know where Belarus is. But, of course, unfortunately, the problem is the same public will cough up the money for this and, heaven forbid, hapless soldiers to be killed in any resulting war. A war the West can't win under any circumstances. Now, violent acts against people, terrorist acts for a political agenda, of course, are criminal crimes in crimes in every country. As we know, though, they have to be committed against the right people. Right? Riots in the U.S. in 2020 were encouraged and defended by the oligarchy to the point where police were ordered to stand down. Policemen killed were demonized or ignored. Anyone who fought the rioters were jailed, as the St. Louis couple proved. Kyle Rittenhouse and all the rest. Yet in 2021, a very minor and harmless Capitol storming with no damage almost, was met with hysterical, faking indignation to the point of the creation of massive task forces to hunt down anyone who was even remotely present. And the policeman, who died, I think, of a stroke a few days after the event, was worshipped as a deity. These are the same people who were spitting on policemen a few months earlier. Now, here's the thing. Condemning them of having a double standard is to miss the point. That's no way to approach this. They're well aware that it's a double standard. When someone talks about what a terrible double standard, we have to hold their feet to the fire on this stuff, that's a typical amateur statement. Because it assumes that there's any concern for objectivity or consistency at all in the first place. The oligarchy and the media are leftists, and they're the sole reason there's any left movement at all. They're willing to destroy cities and bankrupt their own companies to see leftism promoted. I mean, the anti-Trump stuff on Saturday Night Live, one of my favorite shows, is destroying, they're down 40% their viewership. Everything from the NFL has a massive rating slump. The Oscars, a Starbucks, after they promoted their diversity stuff, had to close 400 stores. It doesn't matter. They will go bankrupt. Because if they deviate from the norm and refuse to go along with this, the punishment is going to be worse than closing 400 stores. They risk total destruction if they deviate from the norm. There is one standard, and it's an ideological one. They're well aware that they defended Snowden forcing a presidential plane to land in Austria. And because they defended it, they couldn't possibly reject the Belarusian case. But they do it anyway. They're aware that it's ridiculous, it's a contradiction. That's only if you believe there's an objective standard to begin with these people. They became journalists to promote leftism. They didn't become journalists just to report what they see. Who wants to do that? They're there, they're crusaders. That's why they're there. These guys couldn't function for 5 minutes unless they promoted that ideology. Ideology is by far not profit. They have lost huge amounts of money just over the last few years, but even longer than that. This stuff, by the way, this cancels. This is nothing new. They've been doing this for decades. Another way you could tell an amateur is that if the media doesn't have a name for something, they don't know it. The cancel culture nonsense. Finally, the press has a name for this. They've been doing this for a long time. Because it didn't have a name, they think it didn't exist. This has been happening for decades. And people like me were condemning it 20 years ago, and were being condemned by conservatives for saying it. As I said, conservatives are an enemy, just like anyone else. And it's incredible that I have to explain to an intelligent person that the American media is a leftist organization, no different than BLM or anything else, or the suddenly silent ACLU, even has to be explained to anybody. But apparently it does. To condemn them for a double standard is to assume that they have an interest in objectivity in the first place. They don't. They can't be held to a standard they don't have. The media are about ideological missionaries. That's what their purpose is. So to condemn the differences between the Ukrainian and Belarusian airliners totally misses the point. The whole purpose of the media is to promote an anti-Russian agenda, which internationally is the highest liberal priority. This is what they're there for. You can't talk about double standards. They don't hold to a single standard. Objectivity is not the issue. That's not what they're there for. There's never been a time where they were objective. So stop talking like that. You know, how do you defend X and not Y? Well, they're aware of what they're doing. It's because they're on their side. That's why. Now, of course, in public, CNN talks about objectivity. And maybe one day they'll be have their feet held to the fire for false advertising, but I doubt that's going to happen. Although Donald Trump tried to make it happen. This is the nature of the regime. And that's the end of this show. I thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.